Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, Steve Gerlach, attorney at Bernstein Shearer, will be talking about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. What's new, what is going on, and some of the new regulations and changes that have been happening to date. We're going to be talking about individual mandate, employer mandate, small group market, and all the challenges that you will face as an HR professional and business leader. How are you, Steve? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me, Dave.
No problem. We're going to be talking about that very famous and very fun topic today. Please, everybody, stay on the edge of your seat today while you're driving. The Affordable Care Act, or commonly known as Obamacare, right?
Indeed.
All right. So there have been a lot of things that have been said about the Affordable Care Act. And the reality is that it seems like every single week changes are happening to the act. You hear it on the news. There's another delay here. There's a delay there. This section might be happening. We get new dates. We get new times. Here in April 2014, tell me a little bit about where the act stands, what we have to think about, what we have to know about. Then we'll get into the details of it.
Sure. Well, Dave, when I look at the act, I look at it from an employer's perspective. There's many, many aspects to it, Medicaid and other changes that are going on, but I try and take an employer's perspective on things. From an employer's perspective, there's really three pieces that they need to be aware of. We've got the individual mandate. We've got the market changes, the market reforms, a lot of which affect the entire insurance market and some of which only affect the small group markets. And then we've got the employer mandate piece, which only affects those employers that are 50 and more full-time equivalents. And then putting those pieces all together sometimes can be very complicated decision-making. And as you said, we've got guidance coming out. We're up to about 22,000 pages of guidance now.
Only 22,000 pages?
Only 22,000.
Only 22,000. I'm sure every business owner and HR leader out there has read all 22,000 guidance pages.
I keep it on my nightstand.
Guaranteed to put you to sleep in a hurry, I'm sure. All right, so you know we have all these three main areas. Let's break it down a little bit if we can.
Sure.
So let's start with the employer mandate because that seems to be supposedly delayed, maybe delayed longer. Kind of give us an update on that.
Sure. It's probably helpful to have an overview of how that mandate works because that tells us what's delayed and what isn't. So the employer mandate, first of all, the employers that are affected by it are those that have 50 or more full-time equivalents. So without going into what is a very complicated calculation, it can't just count your full-timers. You have to count your part-timers, too. You pull all of that in. If you've got 50 or more, then you're a large employer for the purposes of the act, and the employer mandate applies. What that means in a nutshell is that you could be assessed penalties if you don't offer the right kind of coverage to your employees. There are two buckets of penalties. First bucket is a $2,000 penalty. Second bucket is a $3,000 penalty.
Per employee?
Yes, but they're slightly different the way they work.
Okay.
The $2,000 penalty is the really scary one. So what happens with the $2,000 penalty if the employer fails to offer coverage to at least 95% of its full-time employees, they can be assessed a penalty of $2,000 per year per full-time employee. When calculating that, we're allowed to take off the first 30 employees. So, but if we're talking about several hundred employees, that all adds up. And it's not just per employee affected, it's per every full-time employee.
It could add up to tens of thousands, maybe in hundred thousands of dollars.
Yeah. A real simple example, if we take an employer who has 100 full-timers, they don't offer coverage to 95% or more, then the calculation of the penalty will go, we take off 30, so we're down to 70, multiply by 2,000. It's $140,000 a year.
It's a lot of money for any employer out there today.
It's a bunch of money.
It is. So what's the difference between the $2,000 penalty and the $3,000 penalty?
So the $3,000 penalty now assumes that we've offered coverage, but it's not affordable or it doesn't meet minimum value standards. Now, what I want to do with minimum value is just kind of set it aside, because anything that you're going to see on the insurance markets, the carriers are not going to put something out there that's not minimum value. And from an employer's perspective, what you need to do is make sure that that insurance carrier confirms that you're getting a minimum value plan. What it says is that the plan itself is paying for at least 60% of what it covers and not shifting all of those costs onto the employees through deductibles and copays and so forth. So then the next question is the affordability question, which the employers have more control over, but also have more exposure with as well.
Yeah, just a quick question on top of that. As I listen to what you're saying, do HSAs count as part of that? Because HSAs technically would say that an employee has to put the money in, not necessarily the employer, when they're covering that 60%.
Right.
Does that factor into this?
Right. And so from the employer's perspective, that 60% includes any employer contribution to the HSA.
Okay.
But it wouldn't include an employee contribution.
Okay. That was my question. Okay.
Sure.
All right. So we have the two different penalties if they don't, A, either offer insurance or meet the minimum requirements of what this insurance is. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Continue on the employer mandate part.
Sure. So the affordability question is, and this has been a difficult one because it's not easy to get a soundbite around. But it's calculated with respect to an employee's household income, or if an employer chooses to, they can use the employee's W-2 income, knowing that they're not going to get that spouse's income counted in. But what it says is that the employee's portion of the premium for the employee-only coverage cannot exceed 9.5% of that employee's household income, or W-2 income, as the case may be.
So how does an employer determine what a household W-2 income is when all they have is information on the income of the employee and have never asked for income of their spouse or maybe living at home children or other things like that? How does an employer deal with that problem?
Exactly. And that's been a huge question. To make it more complicated, the household income, I'm making the quotation marks here, household income is actually a tax concept. It's modified adjusted gross income. So even if you ask the employee what their household income is, they may not give you the right answer because it's something that it takes an accountant to know.
That really poses seriously a real problem for employers.
It really can. And the IRS has put out a number of safe harbors, the most useful of which is this W-2 safe harbor.
So just for the audience out there, and we are talking with Steve Gerlach, attorney at Bernstein Shore. Explain what a safe harbor is, because I think it's important to define that.
Sure. So a safe harbor is usually put together by a regulatory agency of one kind or another, in this case, the IRS. And what it says is that if you do X, Y, and Z, you will be deemed to comply with the law, and the IRS won't look any further. And if you don't do X, Y, and Z, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're out of compliance, but it means that you don't have that safety of knowing that you're complying with.
You're doing it the correct way based upon what they perceive to be the correct way.
Exactly. So with the W-2 safe harbor, it says that you can substitute the employee's W-2 income for household income into that formula. And so it's helpful in that employers have that information and payroll companies can calculate it on a payroll by payroll basis, but it cuts out anything the spouse might be earning.
Getting back to the employer mandate part, because we went down a little bit of a rabbit hole for a couple of minutes, but that's going to be, you know, the whole show we're going down rabbit
There's
holes.
There's a lot of
There's
rabbit holes.
A lot of rabbit holes to go down. So the employer now has, you know, they have a determination that they are going to pay their employees, 95% of the employees are going to get medical insurance, and they're going to cover 60% or more, and they're going to offer it to, you know, to everyone. So tell me about the next, you know, or most recent changes that say, hey, you have to make sure you do this as well.
Okay. So the most recent changes are really what they're calling transition relief, and fleshing out a little bit some of the pre-existing rules. So the transition relief is what has been framed as a delay in the sort of mainstream press. And there are aspects to this which permit delays with compliance with the employer mandate. but it's not as clean as that. So the nutshell of the real deal, which is still more complicated, is that those employers that are 50 to 99 FTEs, full-time equivalents, those employers have a pass until the beginning of the 2016 plan year.
So only if you have 99 employees or less,
right,
down to 50 being
down
the minimum,
right,
you are exempted for an additional year.
That's right.
Okay.
And although this hadn't been really emphasized, it was a big question as to whether that was going to apply as the beginning of the calendar year or beginning of the plan year, and that's been clarified that it'll start up for the 2016 plan year.
Plan year.
So Okay. Those folks that are on, say, a July 1 plan year, it'll start July 1, 2016 for them. So that's helpful for that sort of mid-range employer. Those with 100 and more, there's still some transition relief, but it's not a complete pass. You have to meet certain standards, such as you have to have had coverage in place as of the end of 2012. You have to have coverage in place as of February 9, 2014. And you have to have covered or offered coverage to certain percentages of your employees or your full-time employees. The one thing that I do find most helpful is you'll remember from our conversation about the penalties that the 95% rule.
Yes.
Until the beginning of the 2016 plan year, that 95% has been dropped to 70%.
Okay, so only 70 till 2016.
Till 2016.
And that goes through this year, 2014,
14, yeah.
15,
yes.
And into 16. Okay.
Yes.
And so if you don't meet that requirement of 70% in 2014
right.
today,
yeah.
Is there a penalty, or does that none of those penalties go into effect until 2016?
So if you don't meet the 70% rule, for example, then the employer mandate otherwise comes into effect on January 1, 2015, and penalties will start to accrue as of that date.
Okay, so basically if you're not in compliance with this transitional stage,
right,
then the full effect of the law goes into effect January 1, 2015, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's kind of like we'll give you a little bit if you do some work towards it. And work your way up through that at this point.
Yes.
Okay, so incentivizing maybe to move on through.
Yes.
The other question I have with this is do employers, are you hearing, some of them trying to determine if they even want to offer health care at all?
Mm-hmm.
So what's your assessment of that?
It's it comes down, unfortunately, I think, to some number crunching. It comes down to some business decisions. So let's take that employer that has 100 employees, 100 full-time employees. The cost of providing health care to those 100 employees will likely be more than the cost of paying the penalty, if you just look at the numbers. One thing we have to keep in mind is that paying those penalties is not tax deductible, whereas paying a health insurance premium is tax deductible. So that's part of the calculus, but even taking that into account, it's probably, for most employers, going to be less expensive to pay the penalties. However, there's lots more to the analysis. For example, are you going to be able to get the kind of employees that you want and keep them there? And it's still largely an accepted practice among employers in the United States that they provide health insurance for their valued employees. So it's a big piece of the business decision.
No, these are big decisions by employers. We're talking with Steve Gerlach. He's the attorney at Bernstein Schur. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back on News Talk WLOB. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan. Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan. Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan? I like bronze, like my tan. Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group. Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we are talking with Steve Gerlach. He is an attorney at Bernstein Shore, and we are talking about the ever-famous Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, however you want to call it today. Steve, thanks again for being on the show.
Happy to be here.
All right. So we're talking about the employer mandate section of the Affordable Care Act. And in the last segment, we talked a lot about the different requirements, some things that have changed, some delays, some penalties, some delayed penalties, all the different parts that have really started to change and come out. I know my bias is not showing as my producer, Debbie Davis, is looking at me here on the air. So we're going to now talk about two more parts of the employer mandate angle. One you talk about is the administrative part, and then you said something about some new rules we were talking during break. Steve, go ahead, take it away.
Sure. So back last fall, the IRS issued some new rules about reporting requirements for employers that are subject to the mandate. So just as a recap, that's any employer that has 50 or more full-time equivalents are going to be subject to these reporting requirements. And they're pretty extensive. We're going to have to report employee demographics, income, the coverage that's been offered to them, whether or not they've taken the coverage, and a number of other items to both to the IRS and to each employee every year, just like we would any other tax return. And this dovetails with the question of providing coverage and who we're providing coverage to, because this is the IRS's stopgap. This is how they're going to know whether we're providing coverage or not. This, we've got the employee reporting under his duties with the employer mandate. We've got insurance companies reporting to the IRS. All of this stuff, and the exchanges themselves are also communicating with the IRS. And so this is all going to go into the IRS meat grinder in Holtsville, New York, and they're going to grind out assessments to employers that they don't think are meeting the mandate requirements. So these reporting requirements are really important to get right, because that's going to be your frontline documentation that you're complying with the law.
Are there penalties or incentives for employers on the reporting side that are different or in addition to the simple penalties having to do with the $2,000 or $3,000 penalty?
So if an employer fails to file,
yes,
it would be similar to if we failed to file other tax returns.
Okay. So it's going to be based on the same model.
Right.
Okay.
And then, of course, that's going to send up red flags at the IRS, which would then could get you an audit.
Yeah. No. Nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that.
Okay.
So the other piece of this that I wanted to mention is that we talked about these penalties on an annual basis, a $2,000 and a $3,000 penalty. But in reality, the way it'll play out is on a month-by-month basis. So the IRS will get all of these reports in. They'll look and they'll say, gosh, employer ABC company, employee Sue Jones should have been offered coverage for May, June, and July, and she wasn't. And so we're assessing you a penalty for those 3 months. And depending on whether we're hitting the 95%, it may be that whole $2,000 penalty, or it may be something else. So that puts the employer, if you step back just a bit, that puts the employer in a position of having to make coverage decisions on a month-by-month basis. Oh, Sue hit 30 hours per week this month, so now we've got to offer coverage. And there are some waiting period issues and so forth in there that we're allowed to use, but at the end of the day, it becomes very complicated. And so what I usually encourage employers to do is use another IRS safe harbor that is very complicated, but less complicated than administering your plan on a month-by-month basis. And it's called the look-back period. In a look-back period, this was guidance that was put out by the IRS in 2012. In a nutshell, an employer is permitted to look back over the previous 12 months and average out employees' hours during those 12 months, and then offer coverage in the next plan year based on that. And provided that the coverage lasts, so the employee then elects that coverage, and the employee's coverage lasts for that entire following plan year, then the employer is deemed to have complied with the law. Very much like the other safe harbors, you do X, Y, and Z, and you're deemed to comply with the law.
So this is the total number of full-timees that are during that previous benefit period, not necessarily year period, or is it year?
Most employers are using a year because that's the longest okay. You're permitted to use, and you stretch out
so
that
for
average.
The year. Yeah. So this would be, if you have a part-time employee and they work over whatever was deemed in the past their full-time hours, you could do it for a number of weeks. And off the top of my head, if it was either 12 or 16 that you could be in, have them work full-time without being full-time,
right?
Correct? So does this still apply with this law in terms of if they, because of a increase in business during a period of a month or two, with their seasonal, that they go from part-time to full-time, and then they go back to part-time, does that still apply, or are they considered full-time for that period?
So there's a handful of questions in there, and if we start getting down too far down the rabbit hole, drag us back up, okay?
I love rabbit holes.
All right. So the employer's first pass is going to be this look-back period.
Okay.
If you've got a seasonal bump, say, from May through August, mm-hmm. then that look back period is going to help, or even May through October.
Yeah, that makes sense, and that's a lot of businesses here on the Seacoast area especially.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. And so in some cases, you don't have to count the seasonals, but that's a very deep rabbit hole, and it's better to say as kind of a blanket approach that look-back period will help with those seasonal employees.
It'll average it out.
It'll average it out.
Okay.
For industries that have a lot of turnover, there's another tool in the toolbox called an initial measurement period. It works kind of like a look-back period, but it starts on the employee's hire date and can run as long as another 12 months. And that basically says, employee, when we hire you, you're a variable hour employee. We don't know if you're going to be full-time or not. And because of that, we're going to measure you for a year. And if at some point during the year we know you're full-time, we'll offer you coverage and so on and so forth. But we're going to measure you for a year. Very helpful in industries like fast food or call centers where there's a lot of turnover, a lot of part-time employees. You don't know how people are going to work out initially.
No, that's great. So a couple questions that have been coming up that we've heard of, things like interns.
Mm-hmm.
So interns that may be there for 6 month period or during a full summertime. I may be there for 4 months, 5 months, maybe intern during the year. Mm-hmm. Could be in the medical profession, for example, that may come in for doing internships at different areas. Do they apply as an employee. Yes, they are employees, of course, but there is a category of internship, and we want to make sure, is that included? And then the other part would be 1099s, which aren't employees, but there's been a lot of talk about 1099s, and a lot of organizations are shifting from employee to 1099 to try to avoid some of this. So talk a little bit about those two, if you would.
Okay. So we did get some guidance in the most recent batch about a month ago of regulations. We did get some guidance on issues like interns, student employees, that kind of thing. So if it's a real internship, they're an employee and they have to be counted. If you're dealing with someone who is more like a work-study person, work-study as a class does not count.
Okay.
All right.
That's
so,
good to know.
Yeah. The other piece to your question is, and that I think that's consistent with the way interns have been viewed for other purposes.
Yes. Yes. So, just the real question was, did this change anything? Right? That's
I don't believe it did.
Okay.
No.
All right.
So the 1099 issue, yeah, and dealing with independent contractors. Okay. And let's touch on staffing agencies, too, while we're at it.
I agree, both.
Okay. The 1099 issue, the law hasn't changed about who's an independent contractor and who's an employee. I think what has changed is that the Department of Labor, the IRS, and the state you know, workers' comp and other folks are stepping up enforcement of these things. And the Affordable Care Act is putting pressure, more economic pressure, on employers to, you know, to say, oh, they're not an employee of mine.
Right.
But at the end of the day, if you're telling someone what to do and where to do the work and you're providing them the means to do that work, they're an employee, no matter what you put in writing. And that's how the IRS is going to view it, and that's how the DOL is going to view it. So that's not the kind of arrangement you want to enter into lightly. It may work for a time, but it's a question of when and if you get caught. So that's the 1099 piece. The staffing agency piece is going to be difficult. The IRS regs on it so far basically say you can't use staffing agencies as a workaround, and that's about all we have.
That's going to be interesting because the staffing agency, the employee, is employed by the staffing company. It's not employed by the employer. Mm-hmm. So technically, nothing the employer does controls that person other than they have to be there between X and X time, and they may take direction in order to do that work. But that has been a very fine line that's always been written between agencies and so forth. So we're still waiting for more regulations on this, or what? Or has anything really changed on that yet?
Here's where I see things coming down. Most of the cases, but not all, most of the cases out there tell us that the client of the staffing agency, the client firm, is usually going to be the employer, and that it's going on that same common law standard, who's telling the employee what to do and where to place the shovel or the flag or whatever they're doing. So most of the time, but not all of the time. I think what's going to happen, there's a bit, and is already happening, is there's some sorting out that's taking place in the marketplace. And that it's some staffing agencies are saying, well, we recognize that you, client firm, are probably the one who has the burden on this, but we're going to help. We're going to help you. And either the staffing agency will actually take on providing coverage, which some of them do, or they'll help their clients with the appropriate tracking and paperwork so that they can comply with the law.
Great. We're talking to Steve Gerlach. He is an attorney at Bernstein Shore. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. We will be right back on News Talk WLOB.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan. Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan. Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan? I like bronze, like my tan. Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group. Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
The HR Power Hour is proud to announce a brand new national sponsor, Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. Sheehan Finney Bass & Green is a full-service business law firm representing local, national, and international clients with innovative approaches and practical solutions. Founded in 1937, Sheehan Finney has grown to 63 attorneys with four offices throughout New Hampshire and Massachusetts and is known for professional excellence, practical counsel, and committed to both its clients and the communities it serves. The firm's labor, employment, and employee benefits group represents private and public sector clients throughout New England. Their attorneys are experienced in all aspects of employment law, labor relations, and employee benefits, and assist employers in effectively navigating a wide range of complex workplace issues. They've been consistently recognized as outstanding in their field by New England Super Lawyers, Woodward White Best Lawyers in America, Chambers USA, and Business New Hampshire Magazine. So welcome, Sheehan Finney Bass & Green, to the HR Power Hour family.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com. Our sponsors for today's show, AARP, taking on issues that matter. Northern Insurance Group, meeting your business, commercial, and personal insurance needs. And the law firm of Jackson Lewis, all we do is work. Today, we're talking with Steve Gerlach. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act. He's an attorney with Bernstein Shore. Steve, we've talked about the employer mandate for the last half hour, and while there's a lot of changes, there's still a lot of things that we're not quite sure about yet. I think that we've given a great overview of it, though. There is this segment called the small group market. So kind of talk about that a little bit, if you would, and explain what that is. I know you have a story you want to tell about it to kind of get people to understand what it's all about, and yeah, then we'll get into the detail.
Sure, sure. So been working with a handful of clients around this question of how much their premiums are going up. And I've seen very commonplace quotes for going into the next year of 20 to 40% bumps in their premium costs. And one of the short-term strategies that folks have adopted have been the early renewals, where renewing in December of 2013 will at least buy you a year going into the following year. But the reality of it is that the small group market is changing, and those changes are driven by the Affordable Care Act. The way that premiums are calculated and rated are changing in that market, and they're looking a lot more like an individual rating system than they have in the past. That, I think, combined with just the general uncertainty in the marketplace is this moving target, this when's it going to be effective.
It's constantly moving, absolutely.
So that is also driving premiums up. So we've got a lot of clients who are looking at this puzzle and trying to pull the pieces together, and they're looking at all kinds of different strategies. They're looking at going self-insured. They're looking at doing a piece of self-insured and a piece maybe with a captive insurer. Others I know have looked at MainSense and have jumped right into the full captive insurer arrangement. Other scenarios that I've seen have been folks who, as you discussed, you know, just saying we're not going to provide this.
That's right.
In the small group,
the exchange.
If you're under 50, you're not going to be penalized for making that decision. It's once you get over that 50 mark that the penalties start to kick in. So some small employers, and that. It depends on what market you're in, but it may not be all bad for the employees. So I've seen a number of situations, and I think it's really important for employers to make considered decisions and not jump into a new arrangement that necessarily promises, okay, we're going to have lower costs for a while. Self-insurance, for example, is a higher administrative lift. It's more work.
It is, no question about that. And there's some costs behind it. You have to have some money to be able to do that.
You do. There's a higher risk. You're trading off the hope of lower costs, because it usually takes a few years to get there. You're trading off the hope of lower costs for assuming a higher risk. So looking at these arrangements with a real close eye, looking at the captive arrangements with a real close eye, be very helpful for folks. And to be honest, I mean, that those changes are not limited to the small group market, but I think this past year with those quotes going up 20, 40, I've heard
and
as high as 60.
I mean, that's huge. And there are a lot of small employers that could be detrimental to their business in terms of the total dollars of a 40, 60% increase. I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is. And in states like Maine, where most of our businesses are small,
it's a huge impact.
It's a huge impact.
So really nothing's changed for the small group market. It still applies for 2014. There's been no delays that we're aware of past this. Everything's now in effect, correct?
Correct, yes.
And
the only effective delay is when the employers have taken the early renewal.
Taken the early renewal part. Yeah. And as one of those employers, I can tell you it did. It saved almost 40% from my standpoint. So that's a huge deal in terms of the costs and efforts. And
it is.
I certainly can understand why employers are considering sending people to the exchanges when you're really talking about a huge increase like that. And there is a dilemma of you're trying to hire good talent, and yes, employers today still, for the most part, offer medical insurance, and that is going to be either an evolution or a shift. Mm-hmm. We'll have to see where that actually goes.
Yes.
In terms of. Mm-hmm. All right, so we've kind of talked a little bit about the small group market. We're now going to talk about the individual mandate.
Yeah.
So anything new on the individual mandate, any different regulations, rules, changes, or anything that's gone into effect at this point?
Well, there's been some guidance come out that largely, I believe, will be helpful to individuals in figuring out their tax credits and navigating that whole thing, because essentially it's going to be a tax reporting issue. They'll go to the exchange and they'll say, okay, based on this is what I expect for my income for this year, they'll get that tax credit up front and it'll be applied to their premium. And then if they're income increases substantially over throughout the year, which is a good problem to have, but nonetheless, they may owe some money at the back end. And it's, I guess, the sort of general advice with that is, if you do get a raise, a substantial raise, you probably want to go back and recalculate so that you're not getting that credit on a month by month
basis. So, will employers have to drive that in terms of, are there any requirements to say employers have to take a look when they give an employee a raise, that they have to look at that cost structure or change any of that?
No, there's no requirement.
So it's
that.
Just on the employee side. So the burden's on the employee, not the employer.
Agreed.
I think that's important for HR people to know, is that they don't have to build in, like, though it probably would be good to remind the employee.
Right.
It'd be not a bad idea to remind them, because this is so new, people will have to get it in their head to do that, and they maybe have a tax surprise at the end. And I don't know anybody that likes a tax surprise at the end of the year in terms of that. Okay.
Because they're rarely pleasant
surprises. No, they're rarely pleasant surprises at all. The words IRS and surprise should never be in the same sentence whatsoever.
No.
So what are you advising HR professionals, businesses, and individuals to deal with on this individual mandate at this point?
Sure. A couple of things. The first one is, as HR professionals, we are not permitted, and as employers, we're not really permitted to tip the scales one way or another in terms of an employee's decision to go to the exchange or not. That employee going to the exchange, if the employer's coverage is not adequate, as we talked about earlier, that employee going to the exchange can trigger a penalty. But we're not permitted to discourage them from going to the exchange. In another situation, we may be tempted to encourage them to go to the exchange and get coverage. And not, we shouldn't do that either. We should kind of be neutral. We can be providers of information, especially with respect to those exchange notices that came out in October. They were adequate. I've seen some folks that have done a better job drafting their own, but providers of information. And then I think from a strategic standpoint, it's also important to consider that there are certain circumstances where the employer's coverage, the employer providing coverage, may not be beneficial to the employee's family. And this was a big news splash about 2 years ago now, and it's kind of been swept under the rug and other things have come along.
I haven't heard much about this.
So what it is in determining whether a person is eligible for a tax credit on the exchange, they look at whether that person has been offered affordable coverage through an employer. And if they have been offered affordable coverage through an employer, then they don't qualify for that tax credit. In a situation where you have a married spouse, let's say employee works for XYZ company and is offered affordable coverage. That affordable coverage is measured with respect to only the employee-only coverage. It's not measured with respect to the family coverage. So if the employer offers coverage that's 9.5% or less of the employee's household income for the employee's portion of self-only coverage, it's deemed to be affordable. Notice that doesn't say anything about the spouse.
No, it doesn't. Or children, anything, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah.
If the spouse then goes to the exchange, that spouse is deemed to have been offered affordable coverage because the employee was offered for it.
Because the employee was offered affordable coverage. Even though most employer plans, most, don't pay for any deductible amount for a spouse or children, it's typically
children.
Full boat for or a less percentage for a spouse or children on top of that.
Right.
So that hasn't really changed then. It's only based upon the employee, not the family unit.
Right. But if that employer offers coverage to the spouse, even if it's we're not paying anything, doesn't matter, that spouse will not get a credit.
Will not get a credit on the exchange if the employee's plan meets the criteria.
Yes.
Does it matter if spouse works at another company and they switch plans because of an event, a life-changing event, loss of a job, other events that happened? Is this in the law in any way that would be they could go to the exchange and because of that event?
Well, sure. There's nothing to prevent an employee from going to the exchange. The way that would play out, though, is if they've already elected in the year, they can't just undo their election mid-year. They would need to wait, typically, unless there's been an event.
Okay. Yeah. So that really hasn't changed either in terms of it.
Yeah.
We're talking to Steve Gerlach, attorney at Bernstein Scherer. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB.
Yeah.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com, and we are talking with Steve Gerlach. He is an attorney at Bernstein Scher. We've been talking about the Affordable Care Act, and we have gone through the employer mandate. We've gone through the small business section in terms of the groups, the small groups. We've talked about the individual mandate. We've talked about almost everything. So here's the question for you, Steve. At the end of the day, as we head into the last segment here, what are some of the real options employers have out there for dealing with this act? What are some of the things that they can do, great tips that you can provide for them to think about moving forward, some of the things to make it easier for them, other than obviously contact you, which we'll talk about at the end?
Sure. Well, I mean, just to sort of recognize that there's been this legal compliance piece that has come down the pike. And as we've said, it's 22,000 pages of guidance so far. And that's putting some pressure administratively on employers. It's putting some pressure on them financially as well to make decisions about how to best comply with the law. In addition, the ACA is affecting the marketplace in a very profound way, both through these cost drivers and through the uncertainty that it's causing. And we do have experience with this kind of thing in 1974. For example, ERISA came out, another huge piece of employee benefit legislation that we're still sorting out in the courts. And we're 40 years later. So, and I anticipate the same will be true of the Affordable Care Act. So there's this uncertainty that's also, I believe, driving costs up as well, and also making it harder for employers to know what to do. A couple of ideas that I've seen out there. One of which came down the pike in Maine a couple of years ago with Maine Sense and the whole notion of a captive insurer. That appears to be working. It's getting some momentum now in Maine, and it certainly works in other states like Vermont, for example. I do know some folks in New Hampshire that are looking at setting up a captive insurer as well. And for a captive insurer is basically where a bunch of employers, as few as one, really, but in some cases many, including hundreds, they band together and they essentially form their own insurance company. And so that's one option that some folks have been looking at and should look at. Another option is the self-insured option, or they'll call it an ERISA plan. I don't like that particular phrase because almost every health plan, employer-based health plan, is going to be covered by ERISA.
Right, right.
But the self-insured option, and where the typical scenario is the employer will be self-insured up to, say, $50,000 per employee per year. And then after that, there's a stop loss coverage over the top of that. That is a way that can typically reduce costs, but it's a trade-off. We get increased risks, and especially in those early years, if you get a big hit, there's a, you know, God forbid, a car accident or a major illness or that kind of thing, can really sort of, it doesn't serve the purpose of the self-insured. So you need to be on the lookout for that. In addition, the self-insured pieces tend to be a heavier administrative lift in the early years. Once you get the hang of it, once you get your TPA on board and so forth, they do tend to chug along after a while, but initially the change is going to be a heavier lift. And then there's combinations of these. I've seen arrangements where you have different corridors of risk, where the first corridor is self-insured, the next corridor is captive, and the third corridor is stop loss. I've seen arrangements that have, you know, there's outfits from Philadelphia in addition to local outfits, you know, Maine and so forth, from all over the country, Omaha, Philadelphia, Texas, and so forth. I've seen outfits that have offshore entities as part of the captive.
So there really is multiple ways that people can look at this, and probably requires some out-of-the-box thinking, right?
Exactly.
To be able to have employers really take advantage of all these potential different ways of thinking about it. So because they would have things to think about, and because they should certainly contact their employment attorney during these conversations and an expert on the ACA, meaning you, Steve, how can they reach you? Tell the audience a little bit about your practice, if you could.
Thanks so much, Dave. Sure. I'm an employee benefits and executive compensation attorney with Bernstein Schur. Tax attorney by training, but also includes labor and employment law as well. And I've been studying the Affordable Care Act these last 4 years, and I will continue to do so.
Must have been some incredibly fun reading. I can only imagine.
It's been a carnival ride.
I'm sure it has. I'm sure it has. So over at Bernstein Schur, what's the web address?
Web address is bernsteinschur.com.
Well, we can't be much more simple than that, can we?
Nope.
Well, certainly anybody after this show can go to the hrpowerhour.com website, and they'll be able to upload this information as well as contact you directly. Steve, thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And now the HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group. Licensed agents in 28 states, business, commercial, and personal. Go to northerninsurancegroup.com. Why does variable performance pay work? Well, it adds to the bottom line profitability, it helps control costs, it rewards, retains, and motivates future performance for top performers, it incentivizes average performance to improve, it incentivizes low performers to go elsewhere, and it raises the bar for the entire organization. Those are the top tips as to why variable performance pay actually works. And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group at northerninsurancegroup.com. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.